Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember the financial crisis? Yeah, I bet you do. J.P. Morgan Chase got a $13 billion reminder today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 19th of November. Great to have you with us. You know that saying, sometimes you got to spend money to save money? That's kind of where J.P. Morgan Chase finds itself today. The bank has agreed to a $13 billion settlement with the Justice Department. It's all about bad mortgages and J.P. Morgan having sold them off to investors despite knowing they were bad. The fines and restitution are billions of dollars more than any other corporate settlement ever in this country and still might actually be a pretty good deal for the bank. Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us going from New York.
Deep inside the lair of J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon, there have been meetings and more meetings with the board, top execs, all focused on one question. Will we get our money's worth from this settlement? Longtime bank lawyer and Cornell Law professor Charles Kenji Whitehead says they might.
The ability to be able to address this up front now, get beyond this uncertainty, even if it's a large amount, actually has a value to it. And the value is that you can now begin to focus on running the business and turning to any other problems that you might have to address.
Then there's the company's reputation with customers and clients that appears on corporate balance sheets under goodwill. Consultant Elliot Schreiber previously led corporate communications for major firms. He says a big settlement is a bit like ripping off a bandage, getting all the pain out of the way at once.
People kind of are a little shocked, but it gets it out of the news and they go on and continue to do business. So it's probably a smart move for them.
Better a couple days of bad press than months covering a drawn-out legal fight. The settlement doesn't cover all of J.P. Morgan's legal troubles, but the $13 billion does take care of a big chunk of its housing crisis problems. And the final price tag may be smaller. Robert Wood is a tax attorney specializing in payouts like these.
The vast majority of settlements are deductible. Unless J.P. Morgan has bargained away that, they probably can deduct a lot of it.
Yes, that means a chunk of the settlement could effectively be paid by you and every American taxpayer. Don't hold your breath for a heartfelt thank you message next time you're at a Chase ATM. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming soon to our public schools, businesses. President Obama announced a big grant program today, $100 million, to encourage high schools to prepare their students for tech jobs by pairing up with employers. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
Companies are already putting their stamps on some of the country's high schools. Take P-Tech. The Brooklyn High School is a collaboration between New York City's Education Department, the City University of New York, and IBM. Kids graduate in 6 years with associate's degrees in computer systems or electromechanical engineering, and the promise of being first in line for an IBM job. President Barack Obama made a special appearance at the school last month.
Across the country, companies like Verizon and Microsoft and Con Ed and Cisco, they saw what IBM was doing and they said, well, this is a good idea. We can do this too.
The newly announced grants require high schools to partner with colleges and local employers. A fine idea if done right, says Betsy Brand, the head of the American Youth Policy Forum.
The place that business can do the most is by providing opportunities for internships or apprenticeships.
But she says high schools should not be used as taxpayer-funded training programs for specific jobs. Kevin Wellner is a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and head of the National Education Policy Center.
I'd be curious to see whether there are protections designed to avoid these schools, avoid them becoming the same sort of low-track dumping grounds that vocational education has become.
Done poorly, he says, high school job training can push kids onto tracks that leave them unprepared for college or better jobs. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, there was no joy in Mudville. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Two minutes That, plus or minus, is about how long the Gettysburg Address lasted. Today, as you know, is the 150th anniversary of that speech, easily one of the best known ever. It's fundamentally about democracy and freedom and equality and, says Harvard Business School historian Nancy Kane, leadership as well. Nancy, it's good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure, Kai.
150 years ago, still fresh, still relevant, and you say in a business context as well, this speech.
Absolutely. It lays out, you know, where we came from. Mm-hmm. It says where we have arrived, why the path that we're on of change is worth pursuing. And all of that, you know, from 150 years ago, delivered, you know, in less than 2 minutes on a windy field in Pennsylvania.
As much as I love that, and I'm a big history guy, and I do love this speech and what it stands for and the parallels you draw, can you just imagine Jamie Dimon standing up at a J.P. Morgan shareholders meeting and giving a 220-something word speech and then dropping the mic and walking away?
No. To your point, Kai, we see very few, you know, business leaders invoking that kind of power, the succinctness, the framing the stakes, the being candid about the costs in the interest of the larger, big, worthy mission. We see precious little of it.
That whole idea of actually being candid about costs is something we just as a society don't handle well.
Well, I'm not sure. We're not really put to the test as a people. You know, I think about being at, you know, a Starbucks annual meeting last year and a shareholder getting up and just taking Howard Schultz to task for embracing same-sex marriage. And Schultz did exactly that. He said, look, here are the costs, right? A lot of people are going to be angry. A lot of people are going to disagree. But we have 200,000 employees, almost all of whom embrace diversity. And we believe this is the right thing for our people and our company. So in all, you know, and with all due respect, sell your stock. It was extraordinarily powerful. The room erupted in applause.
All right. Howard Schultz and Starbucks, perhaps aside, let me try another one. The feedback loop in which we live today, right? I mean, I don't know how long it took for word of the Gettysburg Address to get out, but I imagine it was several days, if not a week or two. You can't turn around now without instantaneous feedback that sort of short circuits the considered dialogue, either internal within a CEO or a president, Lincoln, Obama, take your pick, or with just the general news-consuming public.
And yet, if you think about a few of the, you know, memorable, thoughtful, serious speeches that, you know, the president has given, I'm thinking actually of one he made on the campaign trail in April of 2008 when he was talking about race in America. Anyone that heard it or heard a part of it knew that it was for real and knew something important had happened. So we haven't lost the facility to recognize thoughtful, right, honest, serious, you know, leadership and change in written or spoken form. But we don't get it very often, and it's usually torn to shreds pretty quickly right afterwards. That doesn't mean that it's not worth making.
Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thanks.
Thank you, Kai.
Best guesses are that American teenagers and or their parents spend something like $30 billion a year on clothing. Turns out, though, that the way they're spending those billions is changing. Big brands used to be able to dictate a certain image of teen cool, and then the kids bought into that. Now those kids are moving away from brands and away from the malls, Kate Davidson reports.
19-year-old Alex Corbo doesn't really care about brands, but she loves clothes. Every morning she wakes up in her dorm at American University and starts scrolling through fashion blogs.
While I'm drying my hair or something, I'll go through like Pinterest or look at Instagram or something just to get some inspiration for the day.
Corba uses Pinterest the way I'd use a cooking site like Epicurious. She enters an ingredient.
Like today I'm wearing a red leather skirt. So if I wanted to think of something to pair that with, look, I already have it typed in. Burgundy leather skirt, red leather skirt.
And tons of outfits pop up, all featuring a red leather skirt. The boho look Korba mimics is truly adorbs. Floppy tan cardigan, black knee highs. These days, teens are mixing and matching. They're increasingly focused on individual items, not brands. And they're promoting their individual looks on social media. Korba goes to Instagram and searches OOTD, Outfit of the Day.
It'll come up with, 17 million posts with that hashtag.
17 million selfies, give or take, where people often list the pieces they're wearing. Selfies aren't Korba's thing, but 17 million.
The big change in brand building today is word of eye. Everyone has a phone, but that phone is also a camera.
Alan Adamson is managing director of Landor Associates. He helps companies develop brand stories. He says social media now makes it impossible to project those stories in a controlled, top-down manner. What's more,
everyone on Facebook and Twitter are becoming more conscious of managing their individual brands. What they project on Facebook is they are branding themselves.
So what happens to the actual brands? Stephanie Wissink analyzes teen retail for Piper Jaffray. She says in 2006, the three big teen retailers, Abercrombie, American Eagle, and Aeropostale, those three A's represented 35% of teen spending on fashion.
They now represent 12%. The brands that have captured that 20 percentage points difference have actually been made up of about 25 different brands.
Add in the growth of online sales and cheap, fast fashion, and that's rough going for the three A's, which occupy a lot of space in malls. Wissink says she used to visit high schools and see teens dressed alike, brand logos displayed. Now the brand dilution is obvious.
We'll see women that are wearing $9.99 H&M skinny jeans and a T-shirt from Forever 21 that was $4.99, and then they're carrying a Louis Vuitton handbag.
For Alex Korba, shopping by piece, not brand, isn't just about style. She's on a college budget with an internship and a part-time job.
I don't have the funds to go into Urban Outfitters and just walk around the section pulling stuff off hangers if I think I like it.
She says she has to shop with a mission, one that's been honed by social media. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
As a physician, I did have to listen to this inner voice. In this case, I was enraged. I hadn't listened to those. I felt like, I'd screwed myself.
How doctors die. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 9 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 15,967. That is, if you're counting 33 points short of the big 1-6. The NASDAQ slid 17 points, about 0.4%, 3931. The S&P 500 down 3 points, 0.2%, ended things at 1787. That J.P. Morgan Chase settlement was met with optimism from traders. The bank shares finished up 0.75% today. All of the other big financials did well as well. Bank of America, dogged with a lot of mortgage problems itself, led the way up almost 1.9% today. Goldman Sachs up about 0.5%. Bond prices, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.71%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases retail sales for October. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes, also for October. And just how far will you go for turkey? AAA releases its Thanksgiving holiday travel forecast, letting us know not only how far you'll go, but how much you'll spend to get there. I'm already making plans for my leftovers. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Should you be the curious type, you're in for a treat. Starting Saturday, you're going to be able to find out where your steak was born. New labeling rules are going to go into effect that mean the labels will have to tell us where the animal was born, where it lived, and where it died. Meat packers aren't all that happy about the rule, but really, are the rest of us even going to notice? From Chicago Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
Your ribeye may be a dual citizen.
It's not unusual for cattle to be born in Mexico, then shipped to the U.S. to be fattened up and then slaughtered at a processing plant here. For the last few years, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has required anybody selling you a binational pork chop to disclose that. The label may say, product of the U.S. and Mexico. Canada and Mexico complained to the World Trade Organization that the old rules essentially discriminated against their ranchers and farmers. WTO agreed. The new rules up the ante. Now there are more details and specific language. Eric Lieberman is a lawyer for the Food Marketing Institute. They represent supermarkets. He says the new rules place burdens on grocers, and he's not wild about the language.
Slaughtered is unappetizing.
Oh, but they could use harvested instead.
Harvested isn't much better, to be honest.
Jason Lusk is an agricultural economist at Oklahoma State University. He says there's not a lot of evidence we'll actually pay more for U.S. born and raised and killed meat.
Consumers say they want information on labeling, but when you observe behavior in the marketplace, you just don't see that same desire translated into dollars when people are shopping.
Even if the new labels are more prominent, they probably won't affect shopping for Thanksgiving dinner. They hit beef, chicken, pork, lamb, and goat. But turkey gets a pass. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Americans just don't die well. We don't die the way we say we want to, which is at home, surrounded by our friends and our family. The numbers from Medicare are that only about a third of us get to go out that way. Most of us spend our last days in hospitals, tethered to machines and feeding tubes, or in nursing homes. But what about doctors? Because this is what they know, right? Are they more successful when it comes to the end of life than the rest of us? Our regular collaboration with the New York Times this go-round is on healthcare. It's going to be in the paper tomorrow. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein gets us going. He begins near Cleveland, Ohio, at the home of Dr. Elizabeth McKinley.
Deep breath. Okay, good.
Brave. You hear that word a lot when people are sick. But when Elizabeth McKinley's family and friends talk about bravery, it's not as much about the way McKinley, a 53-year-old internist, has battled breast cancer. It's about doing what so few of us can, stop fighting.
Wow, listen, that sounds good. That's nice and clear, and you know how we heard that.
Last spring, after McKinley's cancer had found its way into her liver, lungs, and the tissue surrounding her brain, her doctor told her she had two options.
You can put chemo directly into your brain or total brain irradiation.
Blood pressure real quick.
I'm looking at these drugs head on, and either one would change me significantly. I don't want that.
What McKinley wanted was time with her husband, a radiologist, their two college-age kids, and another chance to soak her feet in the Atlantic Ocean.
I want to have another summer with my family, maybe, or a little more time being me and not being somebody else.
So, after 17 years, McKinley stopped treatment for her cancer and started weekly hospice visits to be as comfortable as possible for the short time that's left. Her mother didn't understand. She asked McKinley's husband, Chip Gillickson, if there wasn't something more to do.
And almost bite my tongue to say, do you have any idea how much disease your daughter has?
McKinley and her husband were looking at her disease as doctors who know the limits of medicine. Her mother was looking at her daughter's cancer like a mother, clinging to the promise of medicine as limitless. When it comes to dying, it's surely every bit as wrenching for doctors as it is for the rest of us. But they have a clear advantage. They've seen death up close. They have access to the best medicine has to offer, and they understand their choices.
You've got a lot of knowledge, a lot of awareness of what's likely to come.
That's Andrew Billings. For 30 years as a palliative care doctor, he helped his patients manage pain, map out their treatment options, and planned end-of-life care. Now,
here we are in the infusion unit.
He's the patient with a rare form of lymphoma.
I am hooked up to an intravenous line, which is hooked up to a pump, which is hooked up to me through a port.
Last month, I spent time with Billings as he sat through the first of several hours of chemotherapy at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston.
We've got harp music today, it looks like. I'm going to waft up to heaven.
In the 6 months he's been diagnosed, Billing says being a doctor has helped. For example, he and his wife, Susan Block, also a palliative care doctor, knew just what to do after a round of chemo this summer left him ravaged and exhausted. Block says they asked for Ritalin, the drug often used for attention deficit disorder.
Most patients, I don't think, would know to ask about, could we try some Ritalin to use for this fatigue? And yet, I know, and Andy knows because of our fields, that that's a really great drug and that it makes a huge difference in being able to be more part of the living while you're there.
Being as comfortable as you can is a lesson for everyone to learn, says Dr. Diane Meyer from the Center to Advance Palliative Care at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York.
The people who feel better, who are less anxious, whose pain is controlled, they're not using up all their bodily energy just to get through the day. So I think we're pretty convinced that it will help us live longer as well.
As a doctor, Billings has had a level of control few patients ever get. But even Billings, whose cancer is in remission, hit the same wall so many other patients do. He doesn't have a great handle on his prognosis.
I've looked at the survival curves, and I don't know which dot I am, but there's some dots that are very, very soon. And there's some dots that are a long ways off, and I just hope I'm one of those.
If anyone can coax a prognosis out of his doctor, it's Billings, with 30 years treating patients at the end of life. But even he couldn't.
It's hard to ask those questions, hard to get answers.
It turns out doctors don't like to talk about the end. Studies show few offer patients a prognosis, and when they do, they often overestimate the time someone has left. In fact, the better a doctor knows his patient, the rosier the outlook. Billing says it's the doctor's responsibility to help patients get their bearings.
I think they need to give a prognosis, which can be very simple, like, you know you have a very serious illness, and I wonder if you've thought about it getting worse. In other words, you don't need to go right to your dead ducky. Don't buy any green bananas.
When physicians don't lay out the road ahead, University of Washington Professor of Medicine Dr. Anthony Bach says patients can end up where they least want to be, the ICU.
Many of those people have ended up in those places because they haven't realized the implications of saying, yeah, I'll have that one more treatment. Yeah, I'll have that chemotherapy.
Patients and families often pay a high price for these difficult and unscripted deaths, psychologically and economically. The Dartmouth Atlas Project found nearly 20% of Medicare's $550 billion annual budget is spent on the last 6 months of life. Atlas senior researcher David Goodman did the analysis.
The evidence is very clear that if we respect patients' preferences, most patients will choose less aggressive care and care that costs less.
But what sounds simple can be difficult, even for doctors.
I'm Ken Zeitler. I'm now 64, and I'm a medical oncologist.
Zeitler lives in Raleigh, North Carolina. He's the son of a doctor, the father of two doctors, and a cancer specialist. He was diagnosed 18 years ago with a brain tumor. Consistently, Zeitler and his family have mapped out a clear medical path. Then last June, he woke up with the left half of his body paralyzed after a low-risk biopsy caused a hemorrhage. Zeitler hadn't fully explained to his family losing control of his body was one of his deepest fears, and he regretted it.
As a physician, I did have to listen to this inner voice. In this case, you know, I was enraged. I hadn't listened to those. I felt like, you know, I'd screwed myself.
Zeitler realized afterwards saying no can mean more than turning down a procedure. It can mean dealing with something much harder, the emotional pull of family who want you with them no matter what.
Quality of life means different things to different people, and you have to decide for yourself, I guess with your family, but ultimately it's a personal decision.
Over the last decade, there are signs that the end-of-life choices we're making are slowly shifting. Medicare figures show fewer people are dying in the hospital, and there's been a modest increase in hospice care. And you've got people like Elizabeth McKinley back in Cleveland, a person who just acknowledges what's in front of her.
People always tell me, you know, you've got other options. I don't feel like I have other options. I think my option is to figure this out and go forward.
Since this spring, friends and caregivers have come and gone. McKinley's hospice bed right in the living room. Her daughter calls it meeting death at the front door. McKinley says she liked that expression.
Yeah, I think
I think allowing death to be at the front door allows us to talk more about life in reality, because I think that's what we're talking about.
McKinley's goal was to find a way to maximize a good life. In her final days, friends and families say she did. Elizabeth McKinley died November 9th at home, where she wanted to be. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Our collaboration with the New York Times is called The New Math of Healthcare. You can read all of it in the paper tomorrow or online later tonight, also at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which we follow up on yesterday's news of Walmart employees holding a Thanksgiving food drive for other Walmart employees. A reporter from the New York Times found this bit of advice on the McDonald's website this week. If you're hungry, it says, break your food into pieces. You'll eat less and still feel full. And yes, this is the same company that advised its employees to go on food stamps if their paychecks didn't go far enough. And that's enough from us. That is Marketplace from APM on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow off 9 points, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ down 17 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 dropped 3 points. That's about 0.2% there. Nancy Fargali, John Ketchum, and Jolie Myers are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.